good day.
Today is Thursday, March 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Tanzanian President John Magufuli has died.
Speaking on state television, Vice President Samia Suluhu Hassan said Magufuli had died of a heart condition at a hospital in Dar es Salaam.
Plus,
Britain also announced in its defense report that it will raise the cap on its nuclear arsenal from 180 to 260 warheads.
And addressing the humanitarian crisis in Lebanon. We'll have these stories and more next. Tanzanian President John Magufuli has died at a hospital in Dar es Salaam, according to his vice president on state television. Reuters' David Doyle is up first.
Speaking on state television, Vice President Samia Suluhu Hassan said Magufuli had died of a heart condition at a hospital in Dar es Salaam. The 61-year-old, one of Africa's most prominent coronavirus skeptics, had not been seen in public since the end of February. Speculation was rife that he had contracted COVID-19. Magufuli had denounced measures to stop the spread of the virus and labeled vaccines a Western conspiracy. Last week, officials denied he was ill. Government figures also said Magufuli was working normally and that citizens should ignore rumors from outside the country. Tanzanian police have arrested four people since last week for allegedly spreading false information about the health of political leaders.
David Doyle from Reuters News filed that report. Vice President Hassan, who was 61, should assume the presidency for the remainder of the five-year term that Magufuli began serving last year after winning a second term. She would be the East African nation's first female president. Upon news of Magufuli's death, the U.S. State Department extended Washington's condolences and pledged to continue working with the government to improve ties. U.S. President Joe Biden says Russian President Vladimir Putin will pay a price for his efforts to undermine the 2020 election. His comments follow an American intelligence assessment showing that Moscow meddled in the 2020 election with the aim of denigrating Biden's candidacy. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
He does not hold back on his concerns about what we see as malign and problematic actions, whether it is engagement in the 2020 intervention in the 2020 election interference, a report obviously released just yesterday, their involvement in the poisoning of Alexei Navalny, ongoing reviews that are related to bounties on troops, and of course, the SolarWinds hack. So he's not going to hold back in his direct communications, nor is he going to hold back publicly. And we have still found ways to work together on areas where we have mutual interests, including the extension of New START by 5 years.
Russia denies Washington's allegations of election interference and recalled its ambassador to the United States for consultations. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharov did not cite specific reasons for the ambassador's return, but said relations, quote, are in a difficult state, which Washington has brought to a dead end in recent years, end quote. Police in the southern U.S. state of Georgia are looking for a motive for the shootings at Atlanta area massage parlors where 8 people were killed. The AP's Ed Donahue.
Most of the victims were of Asian descent. Sheriff Frank Reynolds says Robert Aaron Long may have been motivated by hate. They don't know for sure yet. But in talking to him, he may have another motive, sex addiction.
It may be targets of opportunity. Again, we believe that he frequented these places in the past and may have been lashing out.
Authorities also say Long was planning to go to Florida in a plot to attack some type of porn industry. Atlanta's mayor, Keisha Lance Bonham, says regardless of the shooter's motivation,
it is unacceptable, it is hateful, and it has to stop.
This was the 6th mass killing in the country this year. I'm Ed Donahue.
U.S. spy agency said on Wednesday that racially motivated extremists and militia extremists present the most lethal domestic terrorism threats and warned that the threats could grow this year. The assessment issued by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said racially motivated extremists were most likely to conduct major attacks against civilians, while militia members typically target police and government personnel in buildings. The agency said that other domestic extremist categories which concern the government investigators include animal rights and environmental activists, anti-abortion protesters, anarchists, and people who call themselves sovereign citizens who believe they are immune from government authority and laws. A UN official warns political polarization in Lebanon is blocking progress on key reforms and worsening the already dismal socioeconomic situation in the country. Lisa Schlein has that story.
UN Deputy Special Coordinator for Lebanon, Najed Rochdi, says Lebanon is in a state of political paralysis. She says the country has been without a fully empowered government since the devastating Beirut port explosion last August. The explosion of a large amount of ammonium nitrate stored in Lebanon's capital city killed at least 210 people, injured 7,500, rendered 300,000 people homeless, and caused $15 billion in property damage. 7 months after the calamitous event, Rochdi says no progress has been made that would allow families to heal. She says the country's civic space appears to be shrinking. She notes incidents of harassment, repression, and hate speech against certain public figures or activists are increasing. She says the worsening socioeconomic and humanitarian situation is causing tensions to mount between communities.
As Lebanon continues to suffer from the worst economic and financial crisis in its modern history, while grappling with the COVID-19 outbreak and a political stalemate, we are now in a race to support an increasing number of people who are falling beyond poverty into despair.
Rochdi says UN and private agencies have just completed a comprehensive needs assessment of the country. It finds more than 1 million Syrian refugees, as well as nearly 900,000 Lebanese individuals, 200,000 Palestinian refugees, and 50,000 migrant and domestic workers need emergency assistance. She says food insecurity and chronic malnutrition are increasing among all those groups. She warns political, security, and economic pressures combine into a combustible mixture. Rochdi says the government must listen to the grievances of its people and ensure their legitimate demands are fulfilled. And she says they must be allowed to participate in the political process.
In this spirit, the United Nations has been intensifying supports for women's political representation and participation in the 2022 elections. But to restore public trust in government institutions and political leadership, the election must take place on time without any undue delay.
In the meantime, she says the parliament and the caretaker government must fully assume their responsibilities to keep the country afloat. Among the many vital issues to be addressed, she says, is the Beirut port explosion. She calls for a swift and transparent investigation into the devastating event. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Russia hosts a key summit on Thursday to revive the Afghan peace process. It's the first in a series of meetings that make unlikely allies of Washington and Moscow as they try to pave the way for an interim government in Kabul and end the bloodshed. The United States is shifting focus from largely stalled negotiations in Qatar's capital to meetings among key regional countries aimed at pushing Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, Taliban insurgents, and other Afghan political leaders to form a transitory government as soon as possible. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Jelena Porter says the meeting was an opportunity to collectively support the Afghan peace process and promote greater connectivity in Central Asia.
Ambassador Khalilzad will travel to Moscow tomorrow, and he'll be there to share perspectives on ways to bring about political settlement and a permanent and comprehensive ceasefire. And of course, we're hopeful that the gathering will be productive, and we certainly welcome international efforts aimed at accelerating progress towards a just and durable peace in Afghanistan. When it comes to engaging with Russia, again, we're clear that we'll engage with them in ways that always advance American interests, but we're also clear-eyed about the challenges that Russia poses.
In addition to U.S. Special Envoy Khalilzad, the meeting will include representatives from Pakistan and China, a team of Afghan political leaders, government representatives, and a Taliban delegation will also attend. As Syria marks the 10-year anniversary of its civil war, people in Idlib are taking stock of the last decade. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more.
11-year-old Tasneem Hassan and her family fled their home a year ago as government forces bombed her village here in Idlib, the last opposition stronghold, where nearly one quarter, 23%, of Syria's 17.5 million people now live. They went to 8 camps before they found a place to stay. The other camps were crowded and without running water. They would wait for it to rain so they could drink or cook. They finally found a camp with water and other humanitarian aid, but now it's mostly cut off.
Sometimes they bring us hygiene kits, but we don't want that. We need things for children like diapers, milk, and food. We want to eat. It has been 2 months since we received any food aid.
Tasneem doesn't remember a time before the war, but she remembers losing an uncle, her grandmother, two cousins, beloved family friends, and now, she says, hope.
I dreamed that we were happy and going back to our village. It was like before, and our home wasn't destroyed. But those are dreams. Everything will stay like it is.
She says when her village was attacked, her father's life was saved by a member of the White Helmets, a volunteer rescue group that operates in Syrian opposition areas. Ibrahim Mohammed has served with the White Helmets since 2014 and says he has pulled countless bodies, alive and dead, from the rubble of bombed-out buildings, including babies. He dropped out of college and lost his home and so many countrymen, but he did not lose everything.
We are living in the north with freedom, dignity, and on our land. We've lost so many people. Everyone has lost someone from their family.
The battles are almost over in most of Syria, and some analysts have declared President Bashar al-Assad the apparent winner. But rebel groups are in control of Idlib and nearby regions, and locals almost universally say they will flee or fight before trying to live in a government-controlled area. The war is at a stalemate, characterized by sporadic violence and a deepening humanitarian crisis. But 10 years on, locals say, it is not over. Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
If you have questions or comments about any of the stories in today's program, please connect with me on Twitter. You'll find me at It's Steve Miller. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers conducting a University of California, San Francisco-led study of pregnant women detected 109 chemicals in their bodies. The study, published in the journal Environmental Science and Technology, provides evidence that of the 109 chemicals, 55 were never found in humans before. 42 of the substances were so-called mystery chemicals whose sources and uses couldn't be identified by the researchers. The study authors say they detected the chemicals in the bloodstream of the women and their newborn children, and that they got into the blood through consumer or industrial sources. Corresponding study author Tracy Woodruff, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, says that the chemicals probably have been in people for a long time, but weren't found until advanced chemical detection technology was available. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Myanmar anti-coup protesters are fighting back as anger toward the military continues to rise. AP correspondent Charles Deledesma reports.
In Yangon, groups pelt army lines with improvised firebombs after coming under what appeared to be live fire. Video shows demonstrators initially fleeing at the sound of gunfire before returning to hunker down behind tall sandbag barricades. Some took aim with slingshots before tear gas drives them back. The intention behind throwing the incendiary devices isn't clear, as the soldiers were too far away for any of them to reach, but it may indicate a growing militancy among the protesters as the death toll from the violent police and army crackdown climbs past 200. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
In addition, people in Myanmar have one less place to access news after the San Ta Chain, or Standard Times newspaper, announced that its print and online publications will temporarily cease because of disruptions to communications and distribution in the aftermath of the coup. The paper is the last privately owned news outlet to suspend operations. Four other privately owned outlets, including the English-language Myanmar Times, have announced that they are suspending publications since that February 1st coup. On March 8th, the military revoked the licenses for five organizations. All had been reporting on the current situation in Myanmar after the military overthrew the civilian government. And the Independent Investigative Mechanism for Myanmar said on Wednesday that it was closely following the events in Myanmar and that there was, quote, evidence regarding arbitrary arrests, torture, and forced disappearances, and the use of force, including lethal force, against those peacefully opposing the coup, end quote. The Independent Investigative Mechanism for Myanmar was created by the United Nations Human Rights Council and is mandated to collect evidence of crimes in Myanmar and build case files for possible prosecution in regional and international courts. Britain pledged to counter what it calls the strategic threat posed by China as it set out its new 10-year defense strategy this week. Henry Ridgewell reports, Britain is seeking to carve out a new role on the world stage outside the European Union, according to the Policy Review.
In presenting the so-called integrated review to Parliament, Prime Minister Boris Johnson said China presents a systemic challenge to Britain's security.
There is no question that China will pose a great challenge for an open society such as ours. But we will also work with China where that is consistent with our values and interests, including building a stronger and positive economic relationship.
Several lawmakers accused Johnson of going soft on China by seeking deeper trade links. The Prime Minister said those seeking a new Cold War with Beijing were mistaken. He also underscored Britain would remain committed to NATO and security in Europe.
And from this secure basis, we will seek out friends and partners wherever they can be found, building a coalition for openness and innovation, and engaging more deeply in the Indo-Pacific.
To demonstrate that engagement, Britain's new aircraft carrier, the HMS Queen Elizabeth, will make its maiden voyage to the Indo-Pacific later this year. Prime Minister Johnson will visit India next month. Britain plans to spend $292 billion on new military equipment over the next 10 years. Countering China's assertiveness will require a broad response, says analyst Viola Nouwens of the Royal United Services Institute.
This won't just be about sending ships to the region or planes to the region. It will really be about equally investing in new technologies, be that quantum, be that AI, cyber, space, you name it. So it really is a broader challenge than just, I think, the immediate military, visible military things that we know of when we speak about, you know, China's rise and assertiveness in the Indo-Pacific itself.
Britain cannot compete with China's military expansion, says Nouwens.
We do have limited resources, so it is really about finding those angles that the UK already has real strengths in and working with partners and allies on others to try and shore up capabilities, shore up knowledge.
Prime Minister Johnson said the United States would remain Britain's closest ally. Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin are visiting allies Japan and South Korea, with China at the top of the agenda. Blinken spoke to reporters in Tokyo Tuesday.
We will push back if necessary when China uses coercion or aggression to get its way.
China has accused Washington of disrupting regional peace and stability. Beijing has yet to respond to Britain's plans for greater engagement in the Indo-Pacific. Meanwhile, Britain also announced in its defense report that it will raise the cap on its nuclear arsenal from 180 to 260 warheads. Critics say that would breach Britain's commitment under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. The government says it is a cap, not a target. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The European Union's executive arm rolled out its plan on Wednesday for a green certificate. The document will ensure COVID-19 safe travel across the 27-member group by June, even as the region grapples with an uptick of the pandemic and a slow vaccination rollout. Lisa Bryant has the details.
EU leaders will discuss the COVID-19 travel certificate plan during a summit next week. But European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen laid out the basics of the initiative intended to boost summertime tourism, culture, and other struggling sectors.
It shows or states whether the person has either been vaccinated or a recent negative test, or has recovered from COVID and thus antibodies. Secondly, the certificate will make sure that the results or what it shows, the data and just the minimum set of data, are mutually recognized in every member state.
She said the certificate will help safely reinstate free movement within the bloc, a key issue compromised by the pandemic. The idea of COVID-19 travel passes is controversial for a mix of reasons, including the fact relatively few EU citizens have been vaccinated. Brussels says the certificates do not aim to discriminate, will respect privacy and European laws, and will be scrapped once the pandemic ends. Some EU member states have already announced variations of the idea, including tourist-dependent Greece and Cyprus, which have announced a vaccine passport deal with Israel. But others are more wary.
Question concernant le passeport vaccinal.
Meeting in the French city of Montauban earlier this week, Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez hailed the travel certificates as rebooting tourism, but French President Emmanuel Macron raised questions about them. Meanwhile, some EU citizens are expressing concerns. Despite assurances from Brussels, University of Bordeaux doctoral student Johan Nabat, who specializes in policing and privacy issues, still worries the certificates risk violating citizens' privacy rights, displaying much more information than needed. The proposed travel passes come as a number of EU countries confront a third wave of the pandemic, a dearth of vaccines, and doubts about the AstraZeneca shot that is an important component of the EU's vaccination strategy. Still, Commission Chief von der Leyen insisted the EU would meet its goal in vaccinating 70% of adults by summer's end. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
With its estimated 3.3 billion people, the African continent has a population second only to Asia. However, Africa has reported fewer COVID-19 infections per capita than either Europe or North America. But its high-risk citizens have been offered far fewer doses of the coronavirus vaccine than wealthier continents. To help explain the disparity and to talk about how vaccine equity for Africa may be achieved, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Thomas J. Boyke, Senior Fellow for Global Health, Economics, and Development at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's also the co-director of its independent task force on preparing for the next pandemic.
As of today, there are 86 countries in the world that have not administered a single dose of a vaccine against the coronavirus. More than half of them are African nations.
That seems blatantly unfair on the face of it.
But look, at the end of the day, it is not necessarily unfair for different amounts to be distributed to different countries, provided they're going to the nations where the coronavirus crisis is the most severe and where those doses may do the most good. So from that perspective, you can argue that the U.S. using 29% of the world's doses, which we have, is not as egregious as it might seem when the U.S. also represents 29% of the world's cases since November, the latest wave.
So you're saying the challenge then is the nations that are using vaccines out of proportion to the relatively small number of their coronavirus cases.
That's right. And there are also nations being left out. The one that is a good example on the continent is South Africa, which has a significant number of cases and a very limited number of doses to address them. And because of that, they have risks for health workers, but also the broader population.
How bad is the COVID infection rate in Africa overall?
Part of the answer is we don't know. We do have some indications that the problem might be much larger than it is currently reported. We saw, for instance, in Zimbabwe, a number of ministers perish from coronavirus all within the span of a couple of weeks. The true answer is the data isn't quite what it might be. Based on what we do know, Africa represents only about 3.5% of the world's cases.
So how are countries on the continent going to end up receiving vaccine?
In three ways. The first is through COVAX, the multilateral initiative organized by the World Health Organization. So 47 African countries are set to start receiving vaccines by May 20 through COVAX. That can address about 3% of their population's needs. They would target health workers first. The second way countries on the continent will get vaccines is through donation. China has pledged donations to 11 African countries, including Zimbabwe, with an average donation size of about 200,000 doses. India has pledged donations to 10 African countries with an average donation size around 72,000 doses.
These are meaningful amounts, aren't they?
These are meaningful, but pretty small, because you have to remember most of these vaccines require two doses to be fully effective. So you have to cut those in half. The third way is through purchases, and the African Union has been trying to mobilize to supplement what they are getting either through COVAX or donations. That's a good thing in terms of getting vaccination campaigns started, but aren't going to compare for what COVAX is scheduled to deliver for the continent by the end of the year.
How many vaccine doses can Africans expect from COVAX?
2 billion vaccine doses. That's the goal. That's cold comfort, obviously, to health ministers and people grappling with this pandemic. But here I want to emphasize something. Two things can be true at the same time.
What do you mean?
It can be grossly inequitable, and it is, the way this vaccine rollout has occurred. This is by far the fastest we've ever seen a novel medical intervention in a global crisis start to be rolled out in poor countries. I cannot think of a global crisis where we saw vaccines roll out sooner, and it provides us, hopefully, a platform to build on for the future.
Thomas J. Boyke is the co-director of the Council on Foreign Relations Independent Task Force on Preparing for the Next Pandemic. He was speaking to my colleague, Adam Phillips. Reuters' Emily Wither has this story on a landmark legal decision affecting sexual minorities in Japan.
In a landmark ruling, a district court in Japan has said it is unconstitutional to not recognize same-sex partnership. LGBT activists called it life-changing. The ruling on the legality of same-sex marriages is a major symbolic victory. In a country where same-sex couples are not allowed to legally marry, can't inherit their partner's assets, and also have no parental rights over their partner's children. A plaintiff, known only as E, addressed the court.
Only because the gender of the person we love is different, we can't get married. We live the same lives as heterosexuals, have the same troubles and the same joys. Though our lives are exactly the same, the nation wouldn't recognize this. This is clear discrimination from our point of view.
I
The plaintiff's lawyer called the ruling revolutionary. A new law will be needed before same-sex marriages can actually take place, and it could take some time in socially conservative Japan. But a local activist said they can now see a path for us to live our future.
Emily Wither reports for Reuters News. And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.